Pushkin.
Every week at Broken Record, we meet with legends of the industry to uncover the meaning behind the music, the strategy and history that separate the good from the truly great. That's what Mark Chaikin does, but for the U.S. stock market. Mark is a creative legend in his own right. He worked on Wall Street for 50 years, invented three new indices for the NASDAQ, and has predicted some of the biggest market shifts of the past decade, including the recent mania in AI stocks. Now Mark says we're seeing a similar shakeup in the financial markets. He's calling this a new dawn for the U.S. stock market and predicts dozens of specific stocks will soar in the next 90 days. He put everything you need to know in a new presentation specifically designed for people off Wall Street. You can watch Mark's presentation for free at newstocktrend.com right now. Again, the link to watch is newstocktrend.com. That's newstocktrend.com. The most innovative companies are going further with T-Mobile for Business. The PGA of America is helping lower scores and elevate fan experiences with AI coaching tools and 5G connected cameras. AAA is getting more drivers back on the road fast with location telematics. And the Las Vegas Grand Prix is powering race day operations with 5G connectivity, giving fans an experience at the speed they deserve. This is accelerating innovation with T-Mobile for Business. Take your business further at T-Mobile.com/now.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
I want to let you know that Rick has a new podcast called Tetragrammaton. After about 4 to 5 years of recording Broken Record, Rick decided he wanted to talk to more than just musicians. So on his new podcast, he'll be talking to actors, directors, wrestlers, business people, anyone that Rick finds interesting. So make sure to subscribe to Tetragrammaton wherever you listen to podcasts. George Clinton forever changed music with Parliament Funkadelic, whose theatrical sci-fi performance art has captivated audiences worldwide for over 5 decades and influenced a range of artists from Prince to the Chili Peppers to Dr. Dre. P-Funk's blend of psychedelic rock and deep, repetitive, unfolding funk grooves helped bridge the R&B and rock worlds in the 70s, along with acts like Sly and the Family Stone. Known for multiple characters like Dr. Funkenstein, George Clinton orchestrated multiple solo acts under the P-Funk umbrella, and by the 80s was charting with solo hits himself like Atomic Dog, all of which would lay the groundwork for hip-hop's classic G-Funk era and beyond. On today's episode, Rick Rubin talks to George Clinton on Zoom about the origins of the original vocal group, The Parliaments, and the time George was on a panel with James Brown and dared the godfather of funk and soul himself to do the splits 18 times. This is Broken Record, liner notes for the digital age. I'm Justin Richmond. In true George Clinton fashion, he funked up his recording, but, you know, it's all good because we want the funk anyway. So here's Rick Rubin with George Clinton.
It's a pleasure to see you, sir. Been a minute.
Same here. Yeah.
I love your hat, by the way.
Oh, yeah. Now I have to keep my dome. You know, it was the hair before. I got to keep the dome occupied at all times.
I like it. I watched a video of you from 1969 or 1970, and everybody in the group had the best hats. You weren't wearing a hat. Everybody else had a hat. You had a mohawk.
Oh, yeah. I remember that. I always tried to do something weird with the hair. You know, I was a barber.
I didn't know that. Tell me about your life before music.
Okay, man. 1956. We started the group, okay? 13 years old. We started the group because of, you know, like Frankie Lyman and the Teenagers. You know, Why Do Fools Fall in Love. Doo-wop was the main music.
Yeah.
Doo-wop was the music in Newark, New Jersey. And so I started a group. And one of the first things you had to do in the group in those days was get a do. You know, your hair with the waves in it.
I see.
We couldn't go to the barbershop and get it done because it cost too much. So we learned to do each other's hair. So while we was learning to sing and doo-wop, right up into 1959, we was working in the barbershop, singing at the same time, rehearsing in the barbershop. The Miracle, Smokey and the Miracles come out, you know, the Motown thing come out. So that was our destination. From then on to be on Motown, singing doo-wop, and doing each other's hair, looking like the Temptations. We did exactly that from 59 to like 66. When we got our first hit record, I Just Want to Testify.
Incredible.
In Detroit, after working for Motown, you know, Joe Bett, most of that time, you know, as a writer, we weren't signed to, you know, we never got a record out on the label. We were signed to the label for a minute, but we didn't get a record out. But the competition, right down the street, Golden World for Motown, I got a job there and I recorded I Just Want to Testify. And that became the hit of Detroit, you know, and we were like the competition for a minute. But we immediately changed, I think, because it was too late by then, if the European invasion was happening. You know, and the Rolling Stone, Beatles, and Led Zeppelins, and all of that was happening. So we realized then, because we had a real good backup band, which was like our little brothers, Eddie Hazel, Billy Nelson, Tiki Fullwood, Tyle Ross, and Bernie Worrell. But those were the first ones that we did for years. They were called Funkadelic.
But before Funkadelic, it was the Parliaments, and it started in New Jersey.
Right.
Because I think of you as Detroit. I don't think of you as New Jersey. When did you make the move?
No, it started in New Jersey, in the barbershop in New Jersey while we was doing these shows. That's where it started at.
Let's talk more about doo-wop.
Okay.
I never made the connection because you said you did each other's hair. Is the name doo-wop, does it come from the do? Is that why it's called doo-wop?
No, it was a doo-doo-wop, doo-doo.
I see.
Doo-wop. But just so happened, the do's, you know, getting your hair done was what it was called, getting a do. So it did come close to that, but you related it together. That was the style. Remember Nat King Cole and his whole vibe, Sugar Ray Robinson? Those waves, that was the current style back in those days. So if you're going to go into the Apollo, you better had to have a do. You know, everybody was cool, you know, on Friday evening, you got that do, your head was laid, and that was the style.
When we think of a barbershop quartet.
There you go.
That's essentially doo-wop.
Even the gospel versions of that was basically the background singers singing the things that the bass player would play with the drum, you know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
They would sing the musical parts. Whoop doo up, whoop doo up. They would do the harmonies and singing the instrument parts. And that was basically doo up. You know, you had a lot of acapellas that didn't even use music at all. You know, if you ever remember Take Six?
Yeah.
Remember, they was like experts on singing all the parts. Bobby McFerrin.
Mm-hmm.
That's he take the essence of doo wop and make it all the way into jazz. But yeah, that's what doo-wop basically was. We were singing in the barbershop. That's when we rehearsed that in Newark, New Jersey.
Was it always four or five in a doo-wop group, or it didn't have to be that?
It didn't have to be that, but if five was basically standing then you got like the Impressions. They took it to the three. You know, you had Gladys Knight and the Pips, who was four, but the three background was like a group by themselves, even though they was backing her up. They were like another whole group.
Did they come out of doo-wop, Gladys Knight?
Yes. Oh, their first things would have been like, it was on Fury Records, would have been like 59, 60.
Yeah, so end of doo-wop. It was still happening.
Yes. That, you know, Motown just slicked it up a little bit. Mm-hmm. It was still doo-wop, you know, the temps and all that, but they just slicked it up, you know, with the strings and the instrumentation. Motown took doo-wop to the next level.
What was the first doo-wop? Do we know?
No, that would have been in the 40s. Mm-hmm. That would have been in the 40s. I mean, the Ink Spots. Mm-hmm. You know, Louis Jordan would have been one of my favorite of that era. That his was like doo-wop big band, like Count Basie and Duke Ellington. All that. Louis Jordan was like the funk band of that era. Mm-hmm. And they did a lot of doo-wop type stuff.
But doo-wop, I think of doo-wop as a vocal group. I don't think of the band as part of doo-wop. Like the band is a backing band and the group are the singers.
Yeah, but they kind of like did both of that. Louis Jordan kind of like did, like we do in Parliament Funkadelic.
Yeah.
They had the singer and the band part. Like Sun Rock did doo-wop. Most people don't know it. He did doo-wop before he went to outer space.
I didn't know that.
There's a collection of Sun Ra records out of Chicago where he was doing basic doo-wop groups. You know, it's when the Dells first started. Mm-hmm. Yeah, they were like big in 54. The Dells, Oh What a Night, and that stuff. They redid it in the 70s. But they were like one of the groups around when we was still around in the 70s that we compare ourselves to because we had both been there a long time.
Let's talk about what a big doo-wop group was, because now when we think of what a big group is in music, it's different today than it was then. What would be a big doo-wop group? How many people would they get to play to? What would that be like? Tell me.
Okay, but your highest aspiration basically was Copacabana or Vegas. That's all they thought about at that point. And you would have gotten groups like the Platters, mm-hmm. Flamingos, Moonglows. Mm-hmm. I mean, Frankie Lyman and Teenagers, they went all the way to like Michael Jackson. They got to that level international. And they were a doo-wop group. They didn't even have festivals then.
So it was big. It was a big club, basically. It was as big as it got, and that was cool.
We were probably ourselves and Sly Stone are probably the first ones that started playing to, you know, black bands that started playing to the arenas, you know, like the Soldiers Field and things, you know, and that would have been way into the 70s. But we started in the 60s. Along with Ted Nugent, Amboy Dukes, Iggy Pop. Mm-hmm. We all was from Detroit with the same agent. So we played festivals in Ann Arbor and Toronto and places like that, you know, of the rock and roll side. You know, we was called the Bad Boys of Ann Arbor at one time. Funkadelic, when we put out Free Your Mind, Your Ass Will Follow, Mama, What's a Funkadelic, and Maggot Brain. Especially when Maggot Brain came out, we played all the rock festivals.
Why did you move to Detroit?
Motown.
I see.
The thing was to get out there to record with the Motown sound, you know, mm-hmm. musicians. And we went out there and I started writing with one of the competitor companies, which Motown bought out later. I started writing for them and they did the Edwin Stars and, mm-hmm. you know, Daryl Banks, stuff like that, and Parliaments. The Parliament still, you know, we did first records with them, and that's where we got our first hit. But that was how we got to Detroit.
You moved out to want to join Motown.
Yes. Become part of that situation, which I see the same way people see hip-hop today. Mm-hmm. That's the way it was to be at Motown. I tell you what, I'm going back and forth to Detroit. You know, I go to Detroit through the week, Monday to Friday. I go back to New Jersey, and I'm working the barbershop Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. And I go back to Detroit, you know, to write and stuff with Motown.
Amazing.
I do that for a year and a half, I think. And then we get a hit record. I do the last record that I do for Golden World. This guy's getting ready to sell the company to Motown. I do the last record for them, and I leave and go back to the barbershop. I'm there 2 weeks before the record comes out on the biggest station in the country, which was CKLW and WABC in New York. And I had no idea it was coming out. And when, and everybody started hearing on the radio saying, your record is out.
Unbelievable.
And that was the, I want to testify, which became the smash of that, you know, 67, along with Beatles, Sgt. Pepper, Jimi Hendrix, The Cream. And those was one imprinted in my brain from then on when that became a hit. And those were the records that came out with it, you know. And right after that, Sly Stone came out. Before we left Plainfield, his manager, the guy that Dave Kaepernick, that was his manager, told us that, you know, we were good, but he had a group called Sly and the Family Stone was blah, 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 blah. And that I had to brighten up because we were too dark, you know, in our concepts. And he was actually our manager for a minute. We was on a Stone Records, which Dave Kaepernick managed for a minute. And then Sly broke big. We went to Detroit. We had, you know, we had that the hit single out. But we went separate ways for a minute. It took us years. We'll get to that later.
So I want to ask you about the commuting between New Jersey and Detroit, forgetting Motown for a minute. How different was just your experience of life in those two places? Or was it the same? And how would you say they were different worlds?
Put it like this. I work in a barbershop in New Jersey. So you're dealing with Newark, Harlem, and they're like the first ones that was doing those processes. Not the first, but the one that what we call elevated to where it was looking smooth and soft and natural and really fly, as opposed to it still being done and being hard and, you know, glued to your head. So that was my only way of looking at it. There was lots of what they call players in Detroit, Cleveland. They was like preoccupied with that form of lifestyle. New York, New Jersey thought we was cooler with that lifestyle, same lifestyle, but just thought you was cooler in it. So I had to analyze going back and forth to, you know, the players in Detroit and the players in the barbershops around New Jersey who subdued it a little bit. And you had to deal with a deuce and a quarter being the desired car as opposed to an Eldorado or Mercedes, you know what I'm saying, mm-hmm. being the car of choice. But Motown was there, which made the difference. You know, everything at Motown in my head was the coolest in the world.
Yes.
No matter what, we just had to change the hairstyles.
Yes. Could Motown have happened anywhere else? Or do you think that the nature of Detroit had something to do with Motown blossoming?
I think it had something to do, you know, with the city and the, that whole factory car company thing, you know, and it's just been that place where that Chicago started like that. They just didn't get one place to zone in like Motown did. Like a lot of the records came out of Chicago, but they were different labels and things. Same thing could have happened in Minneapolis. When Prince and all of them were together, mm-hmm. It's always been, how do you keep it together? Because the industry ain't gonna let you keep it together. You know, the main thing is to break it up and get whoever's big and everybody wanna be big. So it's, you know, kind of easy to get the good people and give them some money and they leave before you get to where Motown got. Motown was magic. It was like so magic. That particular band, you think of it like all the musicians, the ones that played on it was unbelievable. But then all the singers was like one big family. That was like the first Motown, the review where all those superstars was on the same buses. That's like, I don't know. It was like college.
Yeah, everybody sharing information back and forth. And
yes, I mean, and at that particular time, which was the 60s, school was happening. College was happening. A lot of kids in college was sharing knowledge all over the planet.
We have to pause for a quick break here, but then we'll be back with more from Rick Rubin and George Clinton.
Snagajob is where America goes to hire, with the deepest talent pool in hourly hiring. With access to over 6 million active hourly workers, Snagajob is the all-in-one solution for hiring high-quality employees who can cover all your needs. On demand, temp to hire, part-time or full-time. You name the position: warehouse worker, retail associate, grocery store clerk, fitness trainer, baker, stylist, bellhop, podcast producer. Yeah, Snagajob's got a worker for that. With our easy-to-use platform, you're able to seamlessly post and fill available positions quickly, with a dedicated customer support team to provide all the help you need along the way. Kind of nice knowing you have a talent pool like that in your own backyard, right? Snagajob is the partner you need to keep your business running smoothly. So visit snagajob.com or text snag to 242424 to talk to an expert. Snagajob.com, where America goes to hire.
Every week at Broken Record, we meet with legends of the industry to uncover the meaning behind the music, the strategy and history that separate the good from the truly great. That's what Mark Chaikin does, but for the U.S. stock market. Mark is a creative legend in his own right. He worked on Wall Street for 50 years, invented three new indices for the NASDAQ, and has predicted some of the biggest market shifts of the past decade, including the recent mania in AI stocks. Now Mark says we're seeing a similar shakeup in the financial markets. He's calling this a new dawn for the U.S. stock market and predicts dozens of specific stocks will soar in the next 90 days. You can watch Mark's presentation for free at marketmessage2024.com right now. Again, the link to watch is marketmessage2024.com. That's marketmessage2024.com.
The most innovative companies are going further with T-Mobile for Business. The PGA of America is helping lower scores and elevate fan experiences with AI coaching tools and 5G connected cameras. AAA is getting more drivers back on the road fast with location telematics. And the Las Vegas Grand Prix is powering race day operations with 5G connectivity, giving fans an experience at the speed they deserve. This is accelerating innovation with T-Mobile for Business. Take your business further at T-Mobile.com/now.
We're back with Rick Rubin's conversation with George Clinton.
It's interesting that your first song was Testify. Testify is a word that I associate with church. Was there a spiritual component for music for you from the beginning?
I was around a barbershop where a group called the Gospel Clefs used to rehearse there. And to see the show and the vibe that they would put on was unbelievable. It was like the coasters in church.
Wow.
And that always let me know that was the root of all the music, no matter what the tone was. That was the root. So that vibe, you know, right from the get-go, doo-wop was always the vibe of, you know, church. Like I can remember the Staple Singers or mm-hmm. Mahalia Jackson. Mm-hmm. That stuff when, you know, waking up to breakfast too. And it sounds like hit records to this day. When I go to Texas, all the bands, all the funk bands is in Texas in church.
Yeah, all the best players, all the best musicians. Absolutely.
That's what I'm talking about, yeah.
Yeah, the best. So in the Detroit scene, how was the Motown world and the Detroit rock world part of the same thing? When you were there, did you feel like it was all part of one thing, or did it feel like the Motown thing is really separate from like the Ted Nugents and the Iggy's?
When we got that Funkadelic and Testify was out, we bridged that one instantly, because Motown was already like a Motown playing with those groups on shows with them, but we were immediately a Funkadelic, a psychedelic band. So it changed immediately. At first, well, by the time Ted Nugent and Iggy Pop, MC5, yeah, it was merging right there.
Would everyone play at the same clubs? Like, would someone on Motown and MC5 play at the same venue?
We did. We played with MC5 and all of them.
And they were separate R&B venues?
Oh, yeah. Except for like the Rooster Tail, that's where pop and R&B played. The Fox, mm-hmm. pop and R&B played. Mm-hmm. You know, most of those kind of places, the theaters, everybody played there.
What would you call the first funk record from anybody?
Oh, my God. It would have to be one of those blues things that's, you know, is in the 40s. Those are basically funk records. Mm-hmm. Most of them. I look at, you know, the New Orleans stuff, mm-hmm. you know, the Motown early records. James Jameson, mm-hmm. those bass lines.
Incredible.
That made everything funk. They just had so much strings on top that it was music for Young America. That was the name of their, that was their theme. Their music, the basic rhythm tracks was the funkiest thing that there was. That's what made us, that's who called us the Funk Brothers. They called us the Young Funk Brothers. You know, our backup band, mm-hmm. and that's why we named it Funkadelic. They had a New Orleans vibe on it, but Motown had its own chord changes with it. But basically everything they did, you know, was seriously funky. Pop, nobody identified it with funk because we came along, we did it basic. We went to real raw funk, simple lines, chants, mm-hmm. and extremely, you know, slow.
What's the first time you were ever aware of James Brown?
Please, Please, and Try Me. Those mm-hmm. two, I mean, as you know, they were like blues songs, but you could feel the vibe in it that it was there. But when he started doing Papa Got a Brand New Bag, mm-hmm. from that point on, it was something else. You know, that's when you start seeing bands pop up that imitate him.
Yeah.
You know, once it got to that point, he was like a TikTok artist.
Yeah.
Every city you go to, you can find a band that could perfect his show so good that they could actually substitute as him. I mean, you know, I knew some band was more James Brown than James Brown.
Yeah.
But the work that they had to put in to get those horns, precision. I mean, you watch Maceo do it with us. You watch him do it with Prince. Fred did the same thing with the Count Basie. They all, Bootsy, I mean, came out whole style, you know, from the funkadelic, like we were doing funkadelic first, to the Parliament new stuff when we did Chocolate City, Up for the Downstroke, then Mothership and all of that. And it was still, he brought the horny horns, you know, then with me. And Bernie Worrell, being a classically trained keyboardist, was able to have them play horn parts but with that same kind of precision. So it was like we had two or three generations of styles, you know, the Jimi Hendrix, the James Brown, the Motown, and Parliament Funkadelic all at one time, you know. And that's what we was having, like, 10 albums out at one time in a year with all of the same people.
Yeah. I always wanted to know about why the different band names and why the different labels. How did that happen? And was it on purpose? And tell me about it.
It was the only way to get everybody satisfied. Everybody wanted to be up front and star. So whoever's got a hit, that's who we all become. I see. The backup band for the Brides. And, you know what I'm saying? It didn't matter at the time. We realized that it was hard for one act to survive after, you know, seeing, you know, Motown get to its peak. We realized we had to have them on different labels and different, you know, and that way you could accommodate all the new acts that was coming up behind us that we had. We had loads more.
Yeah, in a way you did what, basically how the Funk Brothers was the root of all of the Motown. You did your own version of that, but instead of building a label, you had artists at all the different labels.
Yeah. You know, like Wu-Tang did it right after us.
Yes.
And they stayed together as a group, mm-hmm. and was all still doing their thing. That was what we were, you know, attempting to do.
Had anyone done that before you?
Not that many. I'll tell you, Phil Spector did. Remember, he had that Darlene Love, mm-hmm. sung on everybody's record. And they had all the groups, the Crystals, the you know, all the raw teens. And Ike and Tina did it a little bit. Remember that Ike and Tina? Yeah, they did. But we just spread it out a lot further because that show and them was stars themselves as, you know, as the JBs. We named them the Horny Horns, and they were already their own stars, so it was easy. And Bootsy was Bootsy, so we made him into Bootzilla. We made him an instant star right from the get-go, you know. And Parliament Funk, then we had built our reputation as a psychedelic band. So it was, when the mothership happened, it was like we had a ship with all these acts on there. The backup girls would become the Parlettes and the Brides.
Was there a particular inspiration for going psychedelic, or was it more the whole movement? Or were there any like key artists who were like, we need to do something more like this?
We had a friend that worked with us, Jimmy Miller. He was the producer of the Rolling Stones eventually. We used to practice our doo-wop thing, and we recorded some records with him and a guy named Jimmy Fallon. And just as we got our first record together, we gave it to Brunswick Records. They released the demo we gave on Jackie Wilson. He went on to do a group called Spencer Davis, Give Me Some Lovin'. He went on to do Traffic, Stevie Winwood. Now, this was like my partner. We wrote together. And I saw what they had did with Spencer Davis, you know, Give Me Some Loving and I'm a Man. I realized that's where it was going, that you know, rock and roll European type of thing. Then Jimmy's records came out. You know, we knew it was Jimmy Jamie and the Flames, you know, with King Curtis. And, you knew him as a guitar player that did tricks and play. He came out with that Are You Experienced. That one let me know we had to do something like that. And the Eddie was about 15 years old, and he was experimenting with the guitar. We just, he could play blues to death, so it was easy for him to get the gadgets and do it.
Were you ever aware of Arthur Lee and Love at any point?
Yeah, that was Sly's heroes.
Really?
Yeah, that was his heroes. The Love Family?
Yeah.
Yeah, that was Sly. He put me onto them.
What's the first time you got to meet and see Sly?
The first time, like I told you, the manager, Dave Kaepernick, was his manager and our manager. He invited me to see Sly in the East Village.
And how was it?
It was through that place away. First of all, you know, at that time, you know, you're tripping your ass off. You know, he played there and told that place down, and I'm trying to think, he played another club that same weekend, and it was unbelievable. He tore that place up.
It sounds great.
I mean, that's, I think he had, what was it, Dance to the Music out. That was, the, you know, and that simple song, when that came out, it was all over.
For all the different scenes that you've seen, so you've witnessed the doo-wop scene, you witnessed the birth of the funk scene. You've witnessed the birth of G-Funk. You've witnessed the birth of hip-hop before that. Would you say that there's a similarity between these things that happen, or is each one of them really different?
It's a similarity. It's a similarity. You know, it gets to that point where it peaks, and it's somebody starts changing it, and you don't think it's the music at first. But then all of a sudden it takes over, becomes the new music, and it works. It becomes the thing, and a new one comes along. Whenever I hear something like ball, 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 you know, that was a doo-wop thing.
Yeah.
And when you hear people complain about, what, that ain't music? What the fuck are you talking about? And then you get to a few years later, it's the same thing.
Yeah,
it all gets to a point of sophistication that the kids have to take over again and bring it back to elementary. so you can go somewhere else. You know, it gets to that peak and you, everybody gets sophisticated and get jazzy or whatever the avant-garde thing is. And then some kids will come along and do something so dumb, get on your nerve, but it becomes the new shit that you, if you want to stay around, you better pick them on how they doing.
It makes it fun again. It's like it gets fun again.
It makes it fun again. Yeah. You know, whenever I hear somebody that, like I say, get on my nerve for whatever reason, if it get on it good enough, I know it's for the good. I know I need to pay attention.
Did you ever get into go-go, DC go-go?
My God, yeah. I give a good song. That one of the first things, Chuck Brown and the Soul Searchers. Mm-hmm. One of the first things they did was, I don't care about the cold, baby. When you're hot, you're too much. When you're hot, you're hot. That was from one of our songs called Up for the Downstroke.
Yeah, I know that record. I used to DJ that record all the time.
That was the birth of their version of go-go then. They used to vamp on that part, and our drummer, Tiki Fulwer, used to play with them. And wow. Like I said, they was the Soul Searchers, you know, at that time. And they did that groove with everything after that.
Yeah.
They did everything with that beat after that worked so thoroughly. They could do it. We used to do the same thing with the group called Mama with the Funk. Whoa, hi, hey. Whoa, hi. We did that for the entire show, like during the early 70s. All our songs would be in that beat, and we just changed the melody or the lyrics and the beat or the lick, but the pocket would stay the same. We did that, and it sounded like we did one song all night with different themes in it.
It sounds great, though, because it creates this, like, hypnosis. You get... The pocket just keeps getting deeper and deeper, and it turns into something else. You know, even without changing, it turns into something else.
Without changing. Well, James Brown could do that forever.
Yes. And,
but one of the best was Fela Kuti. You see, Fela from Nigeria. Mm-hmm. They could play in the morning to the evening. And it'd be that same pulse all day, but, you know, I knew there was something that was changing, but it was always that groove.
Yeah, instead of one nation under groove, it's one groove over the nation, really.
One groove over the planet now.
We have to take another quick break, and then we'll be back with more from George Clinton.
Snag a Job is where America goes to hire, with the deepest talent pool in hourly hiring. With access to over 6 million active hourly workers, Snagajob is the all-in-one solution for hiring high-quality employees who can cover all your needs. On demand, temp to hire, part-time or full-time. You name the position. Warehouse worker, retail associate, grocery store clerk, fitness trainer, baker, stylist, bellhop, podcast producer. Yeah, Snagajob's got a worker for that. With our easy-to-use platform, you're able to seamlessly post and fill available positions quickly with a dedicated customer support team to provide all the help you need along the way. Kind of nice knowing you have a talent pool like that in your own backyard, right? Snagajob is the partner you need to keep your business running smoothly. So visit snagajob.com or text SNAG to 242424 to talk to an expert. Snagajob.com, where America goes to hire.
Every week at Broken Record, we meet with legends of the industry to uncover the meaning behind the music, the strategy and history that separate the good from the truly great. That's what Mark Chaikin does, but for the U.S. stock market. Mark is a creative legend in his own right. He worked on Wall Street for 50 years, invented 3 new indices for the NASDAQ, and has predicted some of the biggest market shifts of the past decade, including the recent mania in AI stocks. Now Mark says we're seeing a similar shakeup in the financial markets. He's calling this a new dawn for the U.S. stock market and predicts dozens of specific stocks will soar in the next 90 days. You can watch Mark's presentation for free at marketmessage2024.com right now. Again, the link to watch is marketmessage2024.com. marketmessage.com. That's marketmessage2024.com.
The most innovative companies are going further with T-Mobile for Business. The PGA of America is helping lower scores and elevate fan experiences with AI coaching tools and 5G connected cameras. AAA is getting more drivers back on the road fast with location telematics. And the Las Vegas Grand Prix is powering race day operations with 5G connectivity, giving fans an experience at the speed they deserve. This is accelerating innovation with T-Mobile for Business. Take your business further at T-Mobile.com/now.
We're back with the rest of Rick Rubin's conversation with the legend, George Clinton.
Yeah, it's amazing, the power of a groove. I think that's, for me, that's the thing that separates funk from the music that came before it, is that the music that came before it relied on the melody, relied on the words. But once we got to the groove being the dominant element of the music, where it didn't even matter if it was a song on top, because for a lot of James Brown songs, they're interchangeable. It's just the groove.
Yeah, but James could switch from one groove to the other one so precise that you forgot about the first groove instantly.
Yeah.
Now, I know they can change tempos and things and end one and start another one without a seam in it, but a complete different feel. It was almost like a drum machine.
Yeah.
Matter of fact, the drum machine enhanced the grooves a lot once they was able to lock in on the clock with the drum machine, you could groove your ass up because you knew that wasn't going to change.
Yeah.
And you could just write everything around it, which has had a lot to do with a lot of what hip hop was doing. Mm-hmm. Once they was able to do that, lock in those samples or those beats, and you know where they was going to stay, by the beats per minute and all of that, you could just do any kind of pocket over top of that. And if you got a good, you know, rhythm in your voice, you know, like somebody like, say, Rakim, I mean, he's the smoothest mama I know against the beats that they lock into.
Mm-hmm. Did you ever get to meet James?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
What was he like? I never got to meet him.
It was funny. When I first met the Chili Peppers, James, myself, Madonna, we was on a panel together for Silverman. His
New Music Seminar.
New Music Seminar, right. And that's where I met the Chili Peppers. There. James and I was on the panel together, and I tried to be cocky and you know, say something funny. So I say, James Brown, give me 18 splits. That mother got up and did fucking 18 splits.
Wow.
And then said, George Clinton, give me two. I got one and I'm like, I one and couldn't get up off my nuts. And then, that was, matter of fact, that was the first time that, you know, that Flea and Anthony and them asked me would I do a record with them.
Was that a fun experience for you working with those guys?
Oh my God, that was fun. You know, they came out to the farm and they were like really kids, you know, and I forgot what it was like to be really kids. And at the time, you know, I guess they had their little fan club, people knew them by then already. And so I had to get them in town for the weekend and let them out for the weekend, do us recording and let them out. And then they go party in Detroit.
That's great.
But we had lots of fun. I think it was it. Flea and I went to see Aretha.
Wow.
You know, a friend of mine took us in his White Roses, Pimp Player.
Wow.
And they were just having the fun of their life. And took them to meet Aretha and her sister at ball.
And was it a concert or was it more like a regular thing where she would just get up sometimes?
No, this was a concert because she was really big and hot at that time. As a matter of fact, her and Annie Lennox did a record during that same period of Sisters Doing It For Themselves or something. Mm. Yeah, they did that record. Matter of fact, in the same studio at the same time we were there.
There was some crossover between musicians between James's band and your band. How did those things come about?
Bootsy came, he had been with James, and they was called the house guests when we ran into him, and that was the rhythm section, him and his brother in the rhythm section. And I guess they just left James about 6 months or so. And this girl, Malia Franklin, said, "This guy Bootsy, he looked like a Funkadelic." And so she brought him around and we met. And I said, "Damn, he definitely looked like a Funkadelic." And then we played a show and we came around and we hung out. And then we just got together and did a couple of that Up for the Downstroke album. We did some songs for that. And by the next time we got ready to do the next record, he said Maceo and Fred had left. And so he called them in to do the session. They all had left James by the time
I see
that that came around. There wasn't no thing between me and James about that. A lot of people thought that there was some words or something. No, we actually recorded together, him, Bootsy, myself, and Gary Cooper afterwards. You know, after that, it came out on the Family series. But yeah, no, we never had any. He's a funny dude, but he was Mr. Brown.
Did you call him Mr. Brown?
No, I mean, I called him James. Okay. He was kind of scared. He thought I was crazy. Maceo told him, "George, he think you crazy. Scared of you." Said, "Don't let him off the hook, man." So I always played crazy around him, you
That's
know.
Great.
Like Sly would wear him out though. Sly would pick at him, you know, just for the hell of it. You know, because I think Roger and Bootsy was calling him Mr. Brown. And Sly would be like, "You ain't calling him no Mr. Brown. He let you call you Mr. Brown. He'll call you Mr. Brown. They gonna call me Mr. Funny. Sly." Oh, he was a clown.
That's so funny. I'm going to tell you a funny story. This was probably, I don't know, I'm going to say 18 or so years ago. A friend of mine came to my house and he said, "I want to show you this new thing." And it was YouTube. I'd never heard of YouTube. It was just in its infancy. And he said, "I want to show you this thing." And then the first video he showed me was Funkadelic from, it seemed like even older than the thing that I said with the hats. Like it was in a local TV station, maybe in Detroit.
Cleveland.
It was unbelievable. And that was my introduction to YouTube, was that video. And it made me love YouTube. Like it wasn't that YouTube was great. It was that I got to see this Funkadelic thing that I never knew existed.
Yeah, is that the one I was crawling around on the floor?
Yeah.
Yeah. That was in Boston. That's Brothers or something like that. But the other one that's just like that is Upbeat in Cleveland, Ohio.
It looked like it was on a TV set.
But we was playing live.
Yeah. Yeah, it was incredible.
Yeah, that was we actually did those kind of shows live on regular TVs.
Wow.
Because, you know, psychedelic, you can actually get away with that, you know. And then there's another video that came out years later. It was of Cosmic Slop. We was in Central Park, running through the tunnels in the city. Yeah. And all this, that was like, we were tripping our ass off. And that thing never came out till years later, years after that record was out. But it's one of the first things you see as Funkadelic when you look up Funkadelic on YouTube now.
Has it always been fun making music for you?
Oh, yeah. I mean, even now, dealing with my grandkids and figuring out how they do the new things and being a part of that that's the fun part of it, trying to come up with something different and be involved.
How did the idea for changing the song structures, because like coming from doo-wop, song structures were more traditional. And then when you moved into funk, it broke free. Tell me about that.
Well, that was it. You know, coming from all those songwriting days of the 50s, you know, you had to write a structured song, two verses, a bridge, and another verse and out. That started changing when it started becoming having your own band, especially if you were around when Jimmy was playing or Grateful Dead or all those groups were just rock and roll into the, you tripping out, going, you wake up and go to sleep with music playing and wake up with the same song playing. Mm-hmm. That was the whole thing of the rock and roll thing, groove. And then when we got back into funk from the James Brown point, you know, on the one, then that was back into the, you know, the long pockets. And Boosie had a lot of changes in the songs that I would take out,
yeah,
you know, after we recorded, because he liked a lot of breaks, you know, but that pocket I fell in love with. And then that just became the thing, just trying to make it loop by itself, you know,
yeah,
get into a loop. And then, like I say, when the hip hop came and could only focus on the one, you know, everything they sampled was in, you know, one, two, three, you know, even time and no beat breaks and stuff. That made you really lock into the one in which, you know, by the time we did something like Atomic Dog, we could go crazy around the track, even though it was backwards. Mm-hmm. We could still, it's still that groove. That's like one of the hardest grooves that we have. You know, it's the Atomic Dog.
Mm-hmm.
Matter of fact, we just did another version called the Q-Dog version of Atomic Dog. It's phenomenal. Wait till you see this thing.
I can't wait.
Video is crazy.
In some ways, also, disco was another movement that really unified the pocket. It was the whole movement was, yeah, about the pocket, the same pocket, danceable pocket.
Again, that's when it, like a, that, like a drum machine came in,
mm-hmm,
and locked it. Mm-hmm. Once, you know, once it, that was, you know, the, all the electronic music like that came in with a pocket after that. You know, I mean, the like disco. I used to like remember Fly Robin Fly.
Yeah,
the silver conventions.
Mm-hmm.
That stuff like blew me away.
Yeah, I Feel Love, Donna Summer.
Donna Summers, I mean. You know, we was with Neil at that time. So we had a thing going with Neil, Donna Summers, Kiss, and ourselves.
Wow.
You know, that was his new label. That's when he had just started his new label. You know, and I had been knowing him since his Buddha days. So we knew we had that thing captured with him because he had the promotion and we had a spaceship and we had that pocket.
Talk about how important radio was back then.
Well, it was radio was everything. You know, you had to go from the R&B and to crossover into, we were lucky if you was in Detroit, there had been a good relationship between, you know, a lot of R&B records and this station CKLW, which was in Windsor. You know, if you got a good record in Detroit, you could get a Windsor and you had a good shot to get half of the country.
Wow.
So that's what Motown was doing. Every time they put a record out, they got it going, they get it on CKLW, and they was on the charts all over the country. We had a good relationship with stations myself, because I went to the station with the distributor. Every time he took a record to the radio station, I would go as a, you know, guest artist, talk to the DJ. And so I had a pretty good relationship with them. So by the time we got back with Neil, what I want to say is, when he come up with this label called Casablanca, we signed with him, Donna signed with him, and Kiss, we all signed at the same time. And the first time he put out Donna's and Kiss, it didn't work at first. But then we put out Chocolate City and Mothership, it worked. And then Donna's worked. Then Kiss, the fan club thing started working. You know, and the label was phenomenal. They're doing a movie of that right now, and Wiz Khalifa is playing myself.
Oh, great. That'll be great.
My grandkids are in the movie. My kids are in the movie. They're playing Parliament Funkadelic.
So cool. I can't wait to check that out.
Yes, next month.
How did the concept for the Mothership come? What do you remember about that?
Pink Floyd. You know, I'd watched them you know, become so big with their production of their show, mm-hmm. you know, and how long they was on the charts forever, you know. And I wanted to do something like that because Friends of Ours was in, remember the play Hair? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Friends of Ours was in the play. So I realized that we had to be more than a group. We had to be like a Broadway play or a big production or something to elevate past the concept of being a band or a group. And so I said I wanted to get a prop that was bigger than anything anybody had done. You know, mm-hmm. Broadway was the place where they found most of the props at. So we got a guy, Jules Fisher, off of Broadway that was doing Broadway plays to do, build the mothership. And that's after I went to Neil, knowing Neil was a promotion and promotion yeah. free.
Yeah.
And you know, and we had a hit record already. The mothership was a hit record. And we knew that. And we said, you get me a spaceship, I'll be able to bring the next two or three albums, you know, with the promotion of the spaceship. You know, it ain't gonna last for just one album.
Yeah.
And he knew what I was saying, and he got hooked me up with a bank, got me a collateral loan, and we got the spaceship. And all the costuming was the expensive part of it, those leather costumes we yeah. bought.
Was Sun Ra inspirational at all or no?
Oh yeah, definitely he was inspirational in the concept, but I was into Star Trek already. I was a Star Trek freak for days. So it was about that. And then to do the play, I knew it had to have a theme behind it. So the theme was to travel, bring the funk to the planet, you know. Great. And Sun Ra was doing that. A lot of jazz musicians was doing that, you know, intergalactic concept.
And tell me about when did you first meet Bambaataa?
Wow. You know, he had to be about 14, something like that. And that would have been like 77, 76.
Wow.
Something like that. And I just know by the time we got the album out, Uncle Jam, mm-hmm. if you look on the back of Uncle Jam's album, mm-hmm. we have the names of our fans on there. You know, because we had a fan club for each city. And Africa Bambaataa is an A, B. His name is first on New York.
Amazing.
Years later, when he started putting out music, you know, we always connected, like, through the fan club thing already. I didn't know what the electronic or the hip-hop thing they was doing yet. I was just getting familiar with it. You know, it was like, part electronic, part rap, part hip hop. I didn't know what they were calling it yet.
Yeah.
But yeah, we stayed in touch. Even when they got the Zulu Nation.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And the Soul Sonic Force was very much inspired by the mothership. Very much.
Yeah.
They looked like they could have been in the band, in your band.
Yeah, well, I mean, Yeah.
Isn't it amazing how, like, you're a fan of something and it inspires you, and then you make something new, and then when the new thing comes out, people think it's this new thing. There's never been anything like it. But all of the roots, like in all the things you've done, the roots of the things that are in it from before, whether it be Pink Floyd, which I never would have guessed in a million years, or Sun Ra, which I would have guessed because of Space is the Place. It's just right. amazing how... through our love of these things, we make something new.
Now, I'll tell you something else. You know, I've been doing painting lately, you know, fine art painting.
Didn't know.
We're going to be at the Met with Lon Horsley. So check her out. She's a new artist. Her theme is on the metaphor of the funk. You know, she's the pyramids with trumpipulated noses. It's going to be at the Met.
Great.
Just check it out.
I definitely will. Beautiful. Cool, man. Well, it's a pleasure talking to you as always.
Thanks, man. Take care.
I love you. I'll see you soon.
See you soon, man.
Thanks again to the one and only George Clinton for hopping on Zoom with Rick. You can hear all of our favorite Parliament Funkadelic and P-Funk adjacent songs on the playlist at BrokenRecordPodcast.com.
You can subscribe to our YouTube channel at youtube.com/brokenrecordpodcast, where you can find all of our new episodes. You can follow us on Twitter at Broken Record. Broken Record is produced with help from Leah Rose, Jason Gambrell, Ben Tolliday, and Eric Sandler. Our editor is Sophie Crane. Broken Record is a production of Pushkin Industries. If you love this show and others from Pushkin, consider subscribing to Pushkin Plus. Pushkin Plus is a podcast subscription that offers bonus content and uninterrupted ad-free listening for $4.99 a month. Look for Pushkin Plus on Apple Podcast subscriptions. And if you like the show, please remember to share, rate, and review us on your podcast app. Our theme music's by Kenny Beats. I'm Justin Richmond.
Every week at Broken Record, we meet with legends of the industry to uncover the meaning behind the music, the strategy and history that separate the good from the truly great. That's what Mark Chaikin does, but for the U.S. stock market. Mark is a creative legend in his own right. He worked on Wall Street for 50 years, invented 3 new indices for the NASDAQ, and has predicted some of the biggest market shifts of the past decade, including the recent mania in AI stocks. Now Mark says we're seeing a similar shakeup in the financial markets. He's calling this a new dawn for the U.S. stock market and predicts dozens of specific stocks will soar in the next 90 days. You can watch Mark's presentation for free at marketmessage2024.com right now. Again, the link to watch is marketmessage2024.com. That's marketmessage2024.com. MuseAura is your access to online music lessons for guitar, piano, drums, and singing. This is your chance to reignite some old musical passions or pick up an instrument for the first time. Connect with more than 100 of the world's best teachers and musicians. You'll get 7 days totally free to try it out. And then it's just $30 a month, less than a single private lesson. I mean, why do we do Broken Record? Not just because we love hearing from great musicians. We do it because we think that there is something beautiful about the appreciation of music. Don't you think we need more of that in our lives these days? That's the mission of MuseAura, to inspire, educate, and connect musicians. Enjoy unlimited personal support, weekly live streams, student lesson plans. It's like having a personal music teacher, only much, much better. Just go to MuseAura.com, MuseAura.com, to start a new musical journey today.
Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino. That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.